Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 117 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, the first of a two-part interview, the novelist Mavis Cheek speaks with James McConachie about her challenging family background and how discovering that she had a brain took her from 60s Dolly Bird, as she put it, to acclaimed author of witty contemporary novels.
I'm sitting in the Wiltshire home of the novelist Mavis Cheek, who has published 15 novels to date that have been described as comedies of manners, although a better description might be that they are satires, acutely observed, and at points ironical investigations of modern morality, mores, behaviour. And of course, they are also comedies in as much as they are funny. Mavis, you didn't come to writing, as I understand it, immediately. This was something that came later in your life.
Yes, it was. It seems presumptuous, but I'm going to say exactly how it happened. I'd left school at 16 with no qualifications, failed my 11 plus twice, B stream of secondary modern. Although I have to say that I think the secondary modern education then was pretty good. And I was a perfect Dolly Bird, and it was the 60s, and everybody wanted sort of working class employees. They were chucking out the Debs and bringing in the working class girls. Democratic blip for 10 years. The Beatles, the Stones, the Animals, all coming from these rough places. Anyway, I was part of that drift. And so I went to work at an art gallery. I went in as a receptionist. I didn't have to do very much, just look out with my large, vacant blue eyes at people. And that was all I had to do. But I ended up running a gallery for them in Albemarle Street, working with people like Patrick Caulfield, Bridget Riley, David Hockney, Colin Self. Fabulous times. And as I say, a sort of democratic blip. And then I'd been told I couldn't have a family. I wouldn't probably be able to have babies, which is all I really wanted to do, have lots of babies. So I thought, well, what can I do after 12 years working at Alecto? I thought, I know, I'll go to college. So I went to college, to an all-women's college in Surbiton, which was fantastic. I did a humanities degree, discovered I had a brain, which I hadn't actually realised until that point entirely, that I had one. Got a divorce from Chris Cheek. Yes, that is my genuine name. Very odd to be called Mavis and end up marrying someone called Cheek. Not a good combination, that. Anyway, good for writing. And then I was with Basil Beattie, the painter, and that was fine. And then I found I was pregnant as I took my finals. And that was a wonderful shock. And I thought, well, this is a little miracle, and I'm going to be at home with this baby. I'm going to stay at home with this baby until she's of an age. And I thought, well, what can I do to justify being at home with her? And also, I was buzzing from all the education I'd suddenly had, all these wonderful things about the Greeks and the Renaissance and Western civilization, development of that, everything in my brain. And I thought, well, I'll be at home with this baby, and what I'll do is, since I'm at home, I'll be a writer. And that is really how it happened. I waited till Bella was about 18 months old, then I joined a writer's circle, a completely bonkers group of us, I include myself in that, went every week, wrote. I think I knew that I had a sort of talent for writing because I'd done well with stuff at school, but I didn't realise I could have any concept that I could be a published writer, but I just thought I'd have a go. That sort of belief that the late 60s brought to women, I suppose. And then I gave myself until Bella was 8. I thought by the time she goes to junior school, I'll have to get a proper job if I've not been published. It took me a long time. I published some short stories in women's magazines. And then I wrote a completely ghastly novel, which I submitted to various people. Carmen Khalil said that if you want your manuscript back, you better send the postage. It was that bad. But another agent, Imogen Parker, looked at it and said, there's something in this. And I met her and we got on very well. And she pointed out to me that I had humour in me and that that was what I ought to be writing. Write like you speak. And I published Pause Between Acts. She took nearly a year to place it, but she did. She placed it with Bodley Head, and that came out in 1988.
Did you have a sense, when you made that pragmatic decision, as you describe it, how long and how hard it was going to be?
No, I had no idea. The thing is, I was living with Basil Beattie, who was a painter, a very respected painter, head of painting at Goldsmiths. Mind you, at that point, it was all conceptual stuff, so as he said, he was number one in a field of one. But Basil was woefully undersold, always. And I absorbed that, that success wasn't necessarily success, and soul, if you like, of what you do is not necessarily measured in sales, money. And he was very good about supporting me, really. I mean, you know, he didn't have to. I mean, supporting me in a sort of creative way. He was a little shocked when it actually happened, I think. Very shocked. But not half as shocked as I was. But I had that understanding that it might take a long time and nobody might, you know, put their money where their mouth was.
And that moment, the way you've described yourself, B-stream, secondary, modern, there is a sense of struggle lurking under those words. And is that first publishing contract, is that not an incredible kind of validation from someone who only discovered she had a brain in an adult education college?
Well, it's just been extraordinary. And, you know, I pinch myself, not every day, obviously, now, but I used to. The very idea that not only that I published a novel, but that all novels used to come out on a Thursday, as you probably remember, and the reviews came out on a Thursday. And I went to the cafe at the end of the road to be on my own, just to see if there were any reviews. And my novel was reviewed in every single newspaper, and it was reviewed brilliantly. And I remember sort of sitting in a heap over eggs and bacon thinking, this is amazing. Not thinking my life has changed, because you don't think that, but you just think this is an extraordinary thing. And just for a moment you dare think, I remember daring to think, hey, you've achieved something, and then crushing it and thinking, no, you mustn't think like that, just get on with the next one.
Is it like, so I'm told, heroin, that one is always chasing that first high again? The first reviews that are positive, the first publishing contract? Or are there other rewards that come again later in as the career develops?
I think it gets better in that you don't feel that it's a one-off. I do remember the kind of rather frightening thought when I was settling down to try and write my second book, that I might not be able to do it again. I always say to people, you know, get through your second book and then you can breathe a sigh of relief and say, yeah, you know, I can do it. I think it was after my second novel that I just had fun with my third one, which was quite sharp, quite a sort of sharply humorous book.
The title of your third, for the readers
who don't know? It was Dog Days. My first one was Pause Between Acts. The second one was Parlour Games. And the third one was Dog Days. And then the fourth one was when I wrote my first real novel, Janice Gentle Gets Sexy, which had lots of subplots and characters, and it was much broader, and it's still many people's favourite, and it's almost mine.
What do you mean, a first real novel?
Well, that the fact that, you know, there were subplots going on, and it had much more of a point to it. It had something to say. It was all came about because I was fed up with books that had heroines called Ariadne and Andromeda, and they're all stick thin and, you know, having a wonderful time. And I wanted to have a romantic heroine who was large at the beginning of the book and never gave up a biscuit. So that's what Janice Gentle was. I went to a publishing party and I actually overheard a conversation between an agent and a publisher. And they were talking about some poor woman writer that they had on their books, and they were saying, you know, we could get so much better sales if she'd only put some sex in it. How can we persuade her to put sex in her books? And I just remember thinking about this poor author sitting somewhere about to get told to, you know, get some, to put some smut in. So it's a book about that too. It's just a richer concept, and And I wrote it without any notes. I knew where every character was in that book, start to finish. I just wrote it. And looking back, it's unbelievable. My brain must have been very, very sharp then.
So in Janice Gentle Gets Sexy, you described how the idea came from overhearing a conversation between publishers. It sounds as if that they think that sex is something that can be sprinkled on a novel, yeah, like a sort of dressing.
Yeah.
I imagine you take issue with that.
Well, A, I've never wanted to write sex scenes, that's to say hands-on sex scenes. I think the build-up is the sexy bit. You know, that's the bit that gets the pulse racing and the sweat going. And actually, to describe the actual sex act itself seems to me a bit like describing eating. You know, we all know what you're doing. There's a certain amount of holes you can use it for. And that's that. Although you could say, I suppose, that 50 Shades of Grey is throwing that out the window. But I think there is this idea that if you tuck a bit of sex in here and there, it will get a readership. You can sort of publicise that, and that's what people want. My own feeling is that it's much more enjoyable reading about the play. You know, you think of Jane Austen. I mean, there's some very sexy scenes in Jane Austen. There's no sex in her books at all, but there's some very sexy scenes of desire and standing back and holding off and all those things. Much more fun, much more exciting.
Do you think women writers come under particular pressure from publishers to put sex in their books on the understanding that this is what women readers want? And again, that rests on another assumption, which is that women writers are writing for women readers.
Yeah.
I mean, it does seem, you know, this whole phenomenon of chick lit, which is not something that I would say you would identify with at all.
Well, I was once called the godmother of chick lit. I think Robert McCrum said Mavis Cheek is the godmother of chick lit. And I thought, since godmother was rather a dark thing to be in that case, I didn't mind that at all. You know, I was the wicked witch of it. I'm quite sure that some publishers take younger authors or possibly older authors whose sales are declining, and suggest that if they beef it up a bit with a, you know, bit of beef, that they might get more sales. I think young authors probably do believe it, and they may try. Agents and publishers can do unspeakable things to new writers. You know, they can tear their works apart and tell them to rebuild them and do this and do that, and, you know, the author, this new young author, will believe them and they'll go away and they'll do it, and, you know, they lose the heart of the matter. You know, if you have a belief in what you've written and you think it's right and someone comes along and tells you it's wrong and it needs to have something else, be very careful is always what I say before you do anything to it. I'm not sure that sex actually sells books, but I think people think it does.
It's interesting that Robert McCrum called you the godmother of chick lit, and you mentioned that shortly after you referenced Jane Austen. Would it be fair to say that Jane Austen is the godmother of chick lit?
Yeah, I mean, on the lightest level of all, Jane Austen is a romantic, not exactly a romantic romp, although I would say Emma is a bit of a romantic romp, but yeah, Jane Austen is about romance and frocks and dancing and all those other things, but underneath is that steely message.
The other side of that, which I would say, as a man who reads and likes even straightforward chick lit, which I certainly wouldn't describe your novels as, is that chick lit is often the inheritor of Jane Austen's acutely observed, often satirical, set in contemporary, looking at the lives of women within social contexts. And that is a very strong tradition that women have occupied.
Yeah, I agree. I've got no real problem with chick lit. I think it's the way it's marketed often that's my problem. It's these pink and fluffy jackets suggesting that women are pink and fluffy. I've always tried with my book jackets to make sure that they are not like that. You know, those lime green fluffy things that came out.
Have you had to have fights with publishers over book jackets?
A lot. Even with Faber, which was extraordinary. When they reprinted Janice Gentle Gets Sexy, the first jacket that they produced for this new paperback of it at Faber was of a young woman lying across a bed wearing a rather pretty crocheted lace jacket, pen in her mouth, looking pensive. She must have been all of 23, and she was about 7 stone. And I said, has anybody actually read this book? And the art director looked a bit green. And I said, this is, you know, Janet Gentle is hefty. And this woman is thin and it won't do. So she looked a bit cross and she went away. And in the end, they came back with a sort of compromise, which was just a leg and a side view of a woman in Bridget Jonesy pyjamas who could have been any size. And I said, well, it's still not really right. And she said, well, I can tell you, Mavis, that we're not going to put a fat person on a book jacket. Actually said those words.
Although, strangely, they were willing to let a fat person, to use that term, be the heroine of the actual book.
Yeah. I mean, I've just come back from doing this talk at the Jersey Ladies Literary Luncheon Society, which was 200 women. And afterwards, so many of those women had copies of Janet Gentle because, you know, they were relieved that here was a heroine that they could actually relate to. I mean, Janet Gentle is probably about a size 16, possibly pushing an 18. You know, she's not gross, but, you know, she's substantial.
And the interesting thing about Janet Gentle for me, perhaps partly as a male reader, is that once you're within her consciousness, reading the novel, the size she is has an impact on how she is perceived, and it's an important part of the novel and its comedy. But I am quite able to empathise with a woman of size whatever.
Mm.
So why that should necessarily be perceived as an obstacle for anyone?
Well, I think it undermines women, actually, that marketing idea. I think the whole thought that women are so stupid that they can't look at a jacket and think, oh, I can't have that because it's, you know, she isn't thin and I might get fat if I read it. I mean, what? I have no idea what that marketing idea was.
Are you conscious, or do you intentionally write for women readers? And do you have much response from men who read your books?
I do get a response from men, and it's really gratifying. What usually happens is that one doesn't get the letters now. I used to get a lot more letters, but of course there's emails and things like that. People don't write so many. But I used to get letters from men saying, dear Mavis Cheek, you know, either my wife or it might be my girlfriend gave me your book to read and I didn't think I was going to like it, but actually I found it very funny, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. So that would be nice, you'd get that. But what you quite often get with men's fan letters was then you get blah-blah-blah-blah, all very nice, like the characters, you know, made me laugh, da-da-da. And then at the end you'll get, but I think you'll find the 350 doesn't go from Paddington on a Tuesday. As, you know, quite often with a man, he would just need to put a little sort of little control element into all this.
The male characters, of course, interested me in many of your novels. I have to say, they quite often don't come off that well.
I did a wonderful talk at Ways with Words. I really enjoyed it, but it was daunting because it was my first experience of the Great Hall. And when I came out of the green room onto the stage, the Great Hall was jam-packed. I mean, it was completely full with people hanging from the rafters. And I got this sudden chill thinking, oh, my God, they've come to listen to me. And there were some brave men in the audience. And one of them at the end of the talk put his hand up and said, it was really nice. He said, you know, I've really enjoyed reading all your books, but it would be so nice if you could write a nice man now. And I said, actually, you're quite right. I will. And I went away and I wrote The Sex Life of My Aunt, I think it was, in which I had two very, very nice... I fell in love with both my male characters in that, the husband and the lover, and thoroughly enjoyed writing them. And they were nice at the beginning, nice in the middle, and nice at the end.
Astoundingly so. I mean, Francis's generosity.
Isn't he wonderful? Wonderful husband. That actually came out of the fact that when I was a young thing, I was courted by a lawyer who was a very rich lawyer who was a little bit older than me, but he seemed incredibly old. And he asked me to marry him, and I didn't. You know, as you always thought, another bus coming along. So he's based on him.
That's interesting. The character is based on him. Does that imply that the novel is, or could be, an imaginary extrapolation of the life you might have led.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. It was an imagined autobiography. Yeah. How clever you are.
Well,
how perceptive.
I partly wondered that because one of the bits of press I read about that novel was that you had based some of the relationship between the heroine and her sister on your own relationship with your sister.
Yeah.
So it led me to think, well, I wonder what else is autobiographical.
Mm.
Perhaps you could describe how that relationship plays out in the novel and then maybe tell us to what extent that is based on reality, because it's a very problematic relationship.
Well, about my sister, yes. Well, I think it's a well-known secret that my sister and I do have a problematic relationship, a very difficult relationship. She's 4 years older than me. She was born in 1944, and she was the golden child of the family. My father was away at war, and she was conceived, and then he went straight off to war. And she'd been this coddled beauty with my mother and my grandmother, just her, and adored. And then my father came back in 47, and it was a horrible experience for her. I mean, he suddenly came in, my grandmother fled. My father and she, my sister, didn't see eye to eye because he didn't know her from Adam. Again, it's well known that he was a boozer and a gambler and a bit of a wife beater and, you know, all those lovely things. And it all fell apart for my sister at that point. And added to which, in 1948, along came me. I was the harbinger of woe, really, at that point. Everything fell apart completely. I was very young, so I mean, I don't remember any of this. I think I was 2 when my father finally left home. So there was all that background. And then, of course, my sister was very bright and she got to grammar school. I never envied that. I mean, it wasn't a problem with me at all. I just, you know, that was fine. I didn't, she did. But she then got pregnant. So her life took that completely different path that girls then did, including going to an unmarried mother's home to have the baby. And there I was having a brilliant time. You know, I was in the art world. This dork of a sister who had been really rather thick and silly, things washed over me all the time. I was quite different from her. You could say I was insensitive, I suppose.
Would she say that?
I don't think she would say that, but I don't think anybody quite ever understood how easy I found life, really. It looked, you know, because on the surface, life looked very difficult, but kids take things in their stride. She didn't. She couldn't. So there she was, suddenly, with her baby and living at, you know, in a council estate in Camberley, and there I was, living the life of Riley in London, going to parties with the Rolling Stones and having a ball. So it's not surprising, I think.
That was Mavis Cheek in conversation with James McConaughey. You'll be able to hear the second part of this interview in the forthcoming episode 121. You can find out more about Mavis on her website at www.mavischeek.co.uk. And that concludes episode 117, which was recorded by James McConaughey and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 118, novelist Cynthia Rogerson contemplates the literary spurs of exile and outsiderhood, wonders whether she would have written any novels if she'd simply stayed at home in the USA, and explains why being a writer is easier in Scotland than in California. Following Cynthia, the playwright and art historian Brian McAvera considers what we've lost in favouring naturalistic, TV-esque theatre over the wider and deeper possibilities offered by non-naturalism. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.